This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi for more information. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi.
Hey, if you were thinking of signing up for a Partially Examined Life citizenship, which would get you access to episodes no longer on our public feed, plus plenty of other bonus audio, and the ability to participate in not-school groups, including and especially the after-show that's taking place on Sunday, June 31st at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Aristotle's De Anima, well, then I encourage you to choose the $50 year-long subscription option, because if you are one of the next 50 people to do that, then we will send you a coupon code for $20 off our PEL 2016 wall calendar. This means the only thing you'd be paying is shipping to get this awesome piece of art and philosophical trivia. And if you don't want a citizenship, you can still enter the code CALENDAR5 at checkout while purchasing the calendar and get $5 off. Thanks. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 132 is something like, what is it to live stoically? And we read several of the moral epistles of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, a.k.a. Seneca the Younger, from around 65 A.D. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer speaking to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And I am Massimo Piliucci from New York City.
Massimo, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be
nice
here.
To have you on.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
I was a longtime fan of your site, Rationally Speaking.
Oh, thank you. That was a long time ago.
So that's a podcast you ran for several years, and now you've switched to doing... Tell us a little about just your current efforts in the area of Stoicism here.
Yes, now I switched to two blogs. One is called PlatoFootnote.org, and that's my sort of general philosophy blog, where I publish things that are concerned either with my profession as a philosopher, I'm a philosopher of science by day, or with general issues in philosophy that I find interesting. The other blog is howtobeastoic.org, and that's exclusively devoted to my exploration of Stoicism, which started, you know, a little bit more than a year and a half ago. And basically, I keep the blog as an open diary of my own readings and commentaries and thoughts about Stoicism, both in terms of theory and in terms of practice.
So this episode is a follow-up to our Epictetus episode from a few months back. I just freshly went back and listened to it, and actually, it was one of the most text-oriented episodes that we've ever had. So I don't think we were unfair to Epictetus in terms of we were tussling from multiple points of view with the actual words that were said, and this is one of the prime Stoic texts. But we did go into that not really having in mind that this is a live, I was going to say pseudo-religious, but it's a live practice movement that was very popular as these things go, as non-established religion practice movements go. Some of our fans encouraged us to get Massimo on here, knowing your work. And so we read Seneca is very practically oriented. And the epistles that we picked out, well, Massimo picked them out. So these are among those that you said your daily practice includes picking a passage from Seneca or Marcus Aurelius or one of the other Stoic masters and just contemplating it a little at the beginning of the day. And then as you go through the day, seeing how it hooks up with things, or looking at the ways in which all the choices you make have ethical implications.
I thought it was interesting that you almost used the word pseudo-religion. I would stay away from that, meaning that one of the reasons I'm attracted to Stoicism, you know, I'm an atheist, and I've been an atheist since I was a teenager. Before that, I grew up Catholic, because I grew up in Rome, literally next to the Pope. I mean, my apartment in Rome was not far from the Vatican. And one of the things that I do find very attractive about Stoicism, other than that it is a very practically oriented philosophy, it's that it's inherently ecumenical, meaning that you can be an atheist, an agnostic, a deist, a pantheist, or even a theist within certain limits, and be okay with most of what Stoicism teaches and most of what Stoicism practices. It's not a religion. It is a philosophy. It's a philosophical framework, which means that it evolves over time. And, you know, we will be talking about what Seneca wrote 2,000 years ago, but of course, there are no sacred scriptures. It's not that because something was written by Seneca or Marcus or Epictetus, then that's it. That's the last word on the matter. Modern Stoics are inspired by the ancient ones, just like I think a better analogy would be modern Buddhists, especially secular Buddhists or ecumenical Buddhists, are inspired by the Buddhist tradition, but they don't necessarily treat it as a religious text or anything that has to be followed to the letter. That was my first comment. The other one is, and that brings us actually to Seneca. One of the things to understand, especially because you're making, rightly so, I think, the contrast between Seneca and Epictetus, is that, of course, the Stoics themselves had a certain number of disagreements on specifics of their doctrines and specifics of their ways of thinking. Stoicism started out in about 300 BCE in Athens with Zeno of Citium, which is modern-day Cyprus, and then eventually it moved its center to Rome, especially during the imperial period. Of course, over the course of those about five centuries where Stoicism wasn't actually actively practiced philosophy, things changed. You know, people made discoveries. For instance, one of the most amusing ones is that the early Stoics, like Chrysippus, who was the third head of the Stoa, believed that the seat of reason was the heart. In fact, Aristotle agreed as well.
Yes, we just covered De Anima.
So it's the whole thing, both in terms of sort of empirical evidence and in terms of concepts, changed over time. And there are some major differences conceptually between Seneca and Epictetus. Epictetus was perhaps one of the most sort of ascetic of the Stoics. He was very much an admiration of the Cynics. The Cynics were one of the Hellenistic schools that inspired Stoicism initially, but the Cynics were very much minimalist about life. You know, they believed in having basically almost no possessions, no family, no friends, nothing. They were just wandering around teaching their philosophy. And Epictetus was very much attracted by that end of the Stoic sort of continuum. And in fact, there is a bit in the discourses where he essentially says, you know, if you cannot manage to be a Cynic, at least be a Stoic. So for him, Stoicism was sort of a second choice. Seneca was very different. Seneca was much more worldly. He was a senator. He was wealthy. He was in the court of Nero, of course. So he was a very different kind of character. And he had a much more palatable, much more sort of mainstream version of Stoicism. So what we're going to be talking about today is quite different from Epictetus. You can think of Epictetus as a sort of the equivalent of almost a Christian monk, while Seneca is more like your priest in a big city or something like that.
So the reason I was saying pseudo-religious is actually more in connection to the episode that we just had on faith, where the emphasis was not on are there matters of alleged fact that are improvable or something, and arguing about whether we can hold those rationally, but whether the overall point of view involved in a religion, that there are many breeds of almost any religion that strive to be compatible with science, that if they make factual claims at all, then they're the kind that certainly are not within the purview of science. And you can even reinterpret it, many of the alleged factual claims, like even God exists, in a not quite factual way. In other words, closer to the way you would establish a normative claim.
Right.
And in reading through Seneca here, and also just in having some back and forth conversation with the various advocates of Stoicism in light of our Epictetus episode, I struck to wonder about the epistemic status of some of these claims of this is what virtue is, or Seneca approaches, well, so he wrote over 100 of these letters. Yes. We only read 6 of them or so. But you could see why he could come up with so much material. It's not because he has so many ideas. It's because he's like a preacher on Sunday who is pulling out, just like you could pick a different passage every day or even the same passage in different days and mull them over. You know, it's about truth is supposed to be simple in some ways for him. And he even says this straight up. He eschews philosophy that is too complicated.
He's not delving into the sort of theoretical underpinnings of Stoicism, although he does allude to some of those, I think. But I think that's the,
right.
At least in what we read, you know, he's giving advice. So it's an ancient advice column.
Correct. That's exactly right. And in fact, let me give you some context about the letters. So the letters were written all to his friend Lucilius a year or two before Seneca's death. So he was retired at this point, not officially, because Nero, the emperor, would not actually allow him to retire officially. But basically, Seneca spent the last 2 or 3 years of his life away from Rome, trying to sort of disentangle himself from what was becoming an increasingly uncontrollable nutcase of an emperor. And of course, as we know, that eventually cost him his life, because, you know, after conspiracy against his life was discovered, he thought that Seneca was involved. Seneca was not actually involved, but he certainly was sympathetic to the conspirators, and so ordered Seneca to commit suicide, which he did. So you need to keep in mind that, yes, these letters were written toward the end of his life, specifically, as you say, almost very consciously as the equivalent of a modern advice column. He's writing for posterity. He's not just writing a letter to his friend Lucilius. He's always careful when he mentions, for instance, other people. He either doesn't mention their names because they're irrelevant to the point that he's making, or when he mentions them, he makes very clear to explain the background so that a reader who is not Lucilius will know what it is that Seneca is talking about. So it was a very conscious collection of Stoic advice. And so it makes perfect sense that he doesn't go into the theory at all. It only alludes to the basic Stoic theory because he sort of takes it for granted. He's talking to an audience that knows the theory. In fact, one of the best places to go for an explanation of the theory is Cicero. Cicero, who was not a Stoic, he was a Platonist, was very sympathetic to the Stoics, especially in terms of their ethics. The other one is Diogenes Laertius, who has an entire book in his Lives of Philosophers on a number of the Stoic philosophers, and he also goes into the theory. Seneca definitely doesn't. He just takes the theory for granted, and then he talks about specific practical things.
And Diogenes Laertius is our primary source and Sextus Empiricus for Chrysippus, one of the better exponents of Stoic theory.
Correct. Chrysippus was the third head of the Stoa when it was still located in Athens. And Diogenes Laertius thinks that Chrysippus' innovations and systematization of the Stoic philosophy was so important that he actually writes, without Chrysippus, there would be no Stoa, meaning that Chrysippus was crucial. Sextus Empiricus needs to be handled a little bit more carefully because he was openly hostile to the Stoics. And so what he says about the Stoics needs to be taken with a grain of salt.
Before we get into the texts themselves, Dylan and Wes, can you say a little more about what you wanted to get out of this time as an addition to our previous discussion here?
So when we did the Epictetus episode, it had been a long time since I'd studied Stoicism in grad school, and we were dealing with the Enchiridion and just a kind of limited text and wrestling with all the sorts of usual things you would think about when you begin thinking about Stoicism. So what are they calling for? A suppression of emotional life, and what does that mean, and how is that supposed to work? So I wanted to get deeper into the theoretical background. What we read of Seneca doesn't do that, but I had a chance to read some secondary stuff, including Tad Brennan's The Stoic Life, Emotions, Duties, and Fate, which I think is a really good, well-written and kind of absorbing introduction to Stoicism. Good for beginners, but doesn't shy away from rigor. So coming to this, I feel I have much more of that background. And also I've been writing this essay relating Stoicism to Freud and Nietzsche. So what interests me is sort of the Stoic approach to mourning versus mourning as a central concept for Freud and for psychoanalysis. And then also anti-moralism I see in Stoicism, this idea that many of the things we typically think of as good and bad are not actually good and bad. And the fact that Stoicism is, you could see it as a kind of virtue ethics. And so Nietzschean virtue ethics, I think, despite his criticisms of Stoicism, is actually related to it. And so Nietzschean anti-morality and Stoic anti-morality, that's another thing I'd like to explore eventually.
Dylan, did you have any sort of opening statements before we jump into that or jump into the text?
I don't have anything in detail. When we had the Epictetus podcast, I found myself in the position of just generically being very sympathetic with the point of view, but finding myself a bit at a loss for how can it possibly be right if it involves such absurd conclusions as I must deprive myself of all sorts of desire. And you're left with the question of how do you get any directedness at all if you don't want anything? You know, why aren't you just a lump on a log? Or isn't there something terribly anti-human, anti our own natural state to cut ourselves off from the very connections that seem to make us live, flourishing human beings? And so I found myself, especially in reading Epictetus, not having a very good response to that, but nonetheless being very sympathetic to the practice as well as a certain kind of pragmatic disposition of cultivating a way of being that is resilient as well as having a lot of integrity, being concerned with the notion of who you are and maintaining that integrity as being sort of the linchpin of the understanding of virtue. And so coming into this, I felt like, well, I'd like to understand more about how all that works.
Yeah, that was in the Brennan too, the intro to his book. Said, before I learned a lot about Stoicism, I had these caricatures of it. And the things that he goes through were very much some of the same things that came out of our actually reading Epictetus.
It's like he listened to the podcast and, and quoted.
Yes, yes. And the basic breakdown seemed to be that either the Stoic is fooling himself, right? You think you can suppress your emotions, but actually they just get bent in a different way. And really the emphasis in the popular culture on Stoicism might be show a brave face. So it's not a matter of actually being at peace. It's a matter of being afraid of social condemnation that you are showing emotion and thereby choosing one pain, the inner pain of stifling this stuff, over another pain, the social embarrassment pain. And so clearly that's not what Stoicism actually is. But on the other hand, if it's not just faking stifling the emotions, what about the alternative? Successfully stifling the emotions. Well, making yourself into a robot, is that really something that you would choose? Isn't that kind of cowardly, the fact that there's some suffering in the world? And, you know, if you fall in love, things might not work out, or you're giving up control, and so you'll inevitably get hurt. If you take on these responsibilities, loved ones, if you really invest your personal self into these things, with the arrangement, you're going to have suffering at the end of it. If you buy a pet, the pet is going to die. So therefore, you should have some sort of emotional withdrawal. And is that really something that we want to choose? And Brennan says, well, no, this is not Stoicism either. So those are the two caricatures. So Massimo, before we get into the Seneca, what's the right answer? That's neither of those.
So the first thing to understand, I think, is that there is an issue here with word usage, right? Now, as you know, philosophy depends very much on careful understanding of the use of terms. And the Stoics, for better or for worse, introduce a lot of technical terms. So when people talk about, let's say, emotions, for instance, in this particular case, we need to be careful, because today we mean something actually quite different from what the Stoics meant. So the word that they use was pathos, which is actually better translated as passions. They made a distinction between pate, which were the unhealthy passions, and eupatei, which were the healthy passions. So right there, that tells you that the point isn't to suppress the emotions or passions, is to keep in check the negative ones and develop and nurture the positive ones, which gives you a very different idea of what the Stoics were after. And then if you start getting into the details, you'll find out that they listed four unhealthy passions. One was pain or suffering, which they defined as the failure to avoid something that you judge bad by mistake. Fear, the irrational expectation of something bad or harmful. Craving or lust, the irrational striving for something that you mistakenly judge as good. And then pleasure, the irrational elation over something that is actually not worth choosing. So it's not even pleasure in general. It's just pleasure about it, things that are really not worth choosing. It's a very, very specific one. If you go to the healthy passions, they include things like discretion, which is a sort of a rational aversion of vice. This idea that you go after things that are actually worth it and not things that are not worth it. Or willing, which is a rational desire for doing the right thing, for living your life in a constructive way. Or joy, which is, for the Stoics, the rational elation over virtue, over cultivating a good life. And the overall goal of the Stoics was not to suppress the emotions, not to suppress the passions, but to reach what they called apatheia. Now, apatheia, it's an unfortunate term, because of course it sounds a lot like the English apathy, right? Which is like, oh, so I'm supposed to be a Stoic. I'm supposed not to care about anything, to be apathetic. No, to be apathetic in the Stoic sense and in the Greek sense means to actually look at things with equanimity. So let me go to your example of falling in love. I mean, the Stoics fell in love. The Musonius Rufus said that it's a good thing to have a family and then you have a relationship and have children and so on and so forth. So it's clear that the Stoics were not counseling not to do those things.
Well, a good thing or a preferable thing?
It was a preferable thing. Okay. That's right. Yes. We need to get back into that distinction as soon as you want to go there. Sure. But let's finish this thing about emotion. So you fall in love. Well, okay. How can you possibly apply equanimity to that idea? Well, what it is that you realize that falling in love is in part sort of an instinct. It comes out of your biology. It's something out of your being a human being. You just have certain lust and certain cravings and so on and so forth. Then you develop, you know, the good love, long-lasting love, is actually developing a much more calm relationship for the person you stay with. The initial phase of falling in love, it's, you know, it starts out with lust, essentially. It eventually develops into sort of romantic phase. But the only thing that we call long-lasting love, it's a much more calm kind of emotion. In that sense, I actually think it is a Stoic type of emotion. It is that kind of content pleasure in being with that person, in having a relationship with that person, in appreciating that person for what he or she is doing. And the equanimity comes in because the relationship is not entirely under your control. The only thing that is under your control is how to behave your best and how to give it your best shot to the relationship. But ultimately, the outcome depends also on another person and probably on things that are outside of both of your control, stuff just happens. And so having equanimity means that even if the relationship should in fact end, you take that as, well, this is one of the things that happened in the world, and I just gave it the best shot that I could. I really was into this thing, but now it's time to move on. I think that's actually a very healthy attitude, but it's certainly not an unemotional attitude.
Filling out this picture, it gets us into this distinction between what is good and what is preferable, because for the Stoic, the only thing that can be good is one's own virtue. And all the things that we might think of as good or bad, for instance, health or sickness or being wealthy or poor or even having someone to love, if we think of that as good, we are engaged in the typical passions and we're engaged in a kind of error.
Right.
Which is not to say we can't prefer things or select things. So there's this sort of two-tier system evaluation. And the idea that we can prefer things or select things has to do with their being in accord with nature. So for instance, when we choose to have a family and a spouse and health and all those sorts of things, it's not because we think they're good. It's because it's natural for us to choose those things. It's in accord with human nature to do those things. And even if we lost them, for the Stoic wise person, at least, or the sage, really, they're indifferent to that outcome from a higher standpoint. So they're indifferent in the sense of you really haven't lost anything if you lose everything in our terms.
It's not that you haven't lost anything. It's that you haven't lost anything that pertains to virtue.
Right. Okay.
So your moral character has not been affected. And that's true, of course.
And you haven't lost anything good, which is to say you haven't lost anything good. So.
Right. You have, however, lost something preferred. So you have, in fact, lost something. It's just that it's not that kind of something that is really, truly have to do with your inner moral fiber. And, of course, it's outside of your control.
I read some about this distinction in Seneca, where he doesn't become actually genuinely theoretical, but there are a number of letters where he talks about the good and what the good is. And it's all in this kind of language where there is an all or nothing distinction between good and bad. Mm-hmm. And then there's this move to get around back into our own language of degrees by using words like preference or that you can have progress without being good and so forth. And I'm wondering a little bit about that distinction, having on the one hand, this binary character of goodness that you've cleaved it off from what we often would think of as a continuum scale and say, well, is it that you're going to say that it is something that's utterly different in kind?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
If it's utterly different in kind, then it's just that we want to make sure as a Stoics, we're being precise about where goodness is and that the criticism would be that if we talked about, well, all the conundrums you get into about talking about goodness of this food or the goodness of a marriage or the goodness of exercise or the goodness or badness of any other kind of action. The Stoic criticism would be, look, you're just making a category mistake.
That's right.
That those things have a whole different way of being understood that has its own consistencies.
Yeah.
And the notion of goodness is something else. And so if that's the case, then I think we need to say a little bit more about that to really parse that difference out.
So maybe one way to say something more is to look at where the Stoics were coming from. Because, you know, one of the things that it's problematic for us moderns is that we take these notions in the abstract without necessarily going into where these notions came from. I mean, why the hell did the Stoics make this distinction between the virtues on the one hand, which are the only good, and, you know, the preferred and dispreferred indifference? And I think that once you look at the history of the Hellenistic philosophies, it's very clear what they came up with. The two contrasts with the Stoic positions are the Aristotelians and the Cynics. So for the Cynics, there were not even preferred indifference. It was all about virtue. That's why, you know, the Cynics went around with no property, no family, no friends, nothing. There was nothing at all. They were just ascetics, kind of like Buddhist monks or something like that. So they had no room whatsoever for anything that most of us would consider worthwhile in life. It was all and only about virtue. That's on the one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, the Aristotelians, the Peripatetics, as they were called. And Aristotle said, look, in order to have a good life, you know, a eudaimonic life, you need virtue. Virtue is a necessary component of the eudaimonic life, but it's not sufficient. What else do you need? Well, you need some degree of health and some degree of wealth and some degree of education. And he actually said even some degree of good looks. Otherwise, your life is going to be miserable. Okay. Now, this sounds actually like a commonsensical notion, right? I mean, it's like, yeah, it's true. If in order to have a good life, I do need a little bit of money, a little bit of education, you know, a little bit of good looks doesn't hurt. Health certainly doesn't hurt and that sort of stuff. Otherwise, I'm going to have a miserable life or at least a more complex and more difficult life, right?
So virtue is maybe necessary for goodness, but not sufficient.
Exactly.
Be as virtuous as you want. And if just things go badly and your whole family gets killed, then nobody is going to call you happy when you die, if that's what happens.
Although the way Aristotle puts it, it's more like extreme misfortune is an impediment to virtue.
I don't know how this particular point of word meaning parses out for the Romans, but in Aristotle, virtue, that word is translating a word that is also used in ways by him, arete, that isn't used by us moderns that way. And in fact, using the word virtue doesn't quite hit the mark in terms of the notion of excellence and inherent excellence that's coming across in Aristotle, where it brings along a stronger moral component.
Yeah. So we tend to think of virtue in terms like that ethically,
yes,
as in terms of how we treat other people. And Aristotle is focused on an individual's happiness as a function of activity in accordance with virtue, which is to say these excellences of character like justice and temperance and things like that. So it's more focused globally on all of your behavior. It's not just thou shalt not kill. It's a much thicker and richer conception of morality.
I agree. So the word virtue, it is unfortunate to some extent, although I don't think we're going to get away from it because the whole approach is called virtue ethics, you know?
Yes, yes. But, no, we're not going to get out of it, but it's worth, right, it's worth bringing up points.
You don't think we should try to get aretetic ethics as a...
Well, actually, you know, I'm surprised that the people use more and more the term eudaimonia as opposed to just flourishing or happiness. So, you know, who knows? Maybe people will eventually use arete. But you're right. I mean, that point was very important because virtue today does have too much of a sort of a Christian connotation to it. While not just Aristotle, but the Greeks in general, Greek Romans in general, they really did mean more something like excellence of character, which is a much broader perspective than just sort of Christian virtue. But to finish that comparison then between the schools, so here's the situation. So you're absolutely right. You can put it in this way, that for the Aristotelians, virtue or arete was necessary but not sufficient for eudaimonia, for the flourishing life. For the cynics, virtue was both necessary and sufficient. Now, here come the Stoics, and they said, no, wait a minute. You're both wrong, and you're wrong in different ways. It's ridiculous to say that virtue is necessary and sufficient because clearly human beings want other things, and they have good reasons for wanting other things. It's not crazy. It's not irrational to want to be healthy and not sick or wealthy and not poor or educated and not ignorant and so on and so forth. So the cynics are too extreme in that perspective. But the Aristotelians were a little bit too aristocratic. I mean, they basically left a lot to chance because things like health and wealth and education and all that are not entirely under your control. It's not that you can decide to be wealthy. You can work in that direction or to be educated. And certainly you can't decide to be good looking. So there are things that they said, so let's make this distinction that what makes your life worth living, what makes you a good human being, an excellent human being, is the thing that is under your control. And what is under your control is the development of your character. Everything else becomes indifferent in the specific sense of being indifferent to your moral character, to your excellence. Now, within those indifference, then we're going to recognize that some of them are preferred, rationally preferred, and some of them are not rationally preferred. And as you said earlier, that distinction is basically made on the basis of human nature. You know, there are certain things that human nature prefers and other things that this prefers.
All right, let's stop for a minute and talk about our sponsors. We're going to bring in Seth Paskin, our missing member, to tell us about a cool thing from the Great Courses.
Hey, folks, we've been talking a lot about the Great Courses, and I'm excited about their new Great Courses Plus video learning service. It's unlimited access to a huge library of Great Courses lecture series in so many of those great subjects that we all know and love, like science, history, philosophy, religion, and so on. Now, we really like what they're doing with the Great Courses Plus. They're giving our listeners an incredible opportunity to check it out right now. You can watch one of their popular courses, The Inexplicable Universe, Unsolved Mysteries, absolutely free. Inexplicable Universe is presented by the well-respected astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Now, for our audience, I don't think we need to explain who that is. You guys know and love him, I'm sure, as much as we do. And I've been watching this series and I really enjoy it. probably because of his engaging style and his ability to take a complex subject like astronomy or astrophysics and make it understandable to a lay but interested audience. It's very similar to what we do with Partially Examined Life. I was just recently watching the third in that series, which is on Inexplicable Life, where he talks about how life evolved and about how we're all related, looking at things from an evolutionary perspective. And of course, he does it in his very down-to-earth and engaging style. So for a limited time, the Grape Courses Plus is offering our listeners a chance to stream this course, which if you bought it separately is a $95 value, for free. You can get this on any internet-connected TV, PC, or through the Great Courses Plus apps. This free offer is only available for a limited time, so hurry up. To stream The Inexplicable Universe from the Great Courses Plus for free, you must go to the Great Courses Plus, that's spell it out, P-L-U-S, thegreatcoursesplus.com/P-E-L. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/P-E-L.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life. So I was trying to describe the hardline Stoic position that what's preferable or not is not relevant to one's happiness, unless it's relevant to virtue. Are you saying it's broader than that, that these preferables are actually relevant to happiness? Or?
No, they're not relevant to happiness as long as one understands happiness as eudaimonia, which for the Stoics was the perfection of character.
As long as happiness is defined as virtue before you even start
Yeah, that's right. Because that's one of the reasons why translating eudaimonia with happiness is problematic. Because we have a very different concept today of happiness. And they say, well, how can I possibly be happy if I'm poor and sick and so on and so forth, right? Well, you can in the sense of being a moral person, even if you are sick and poor and uneducated.
Part of what you have to address there is how that happiness is in some way like what we would normally consider being happy. It has to be that it lines up in some way, like something like happiness properly understood, as opposed to just another word that you just misused, right?
Well, another way of putting this is, I don't see the Stoics as simply arbitrarily defining happiness as virtue, or Aristotle or other virtue ethicists for that matter. There's a real causal claim here. And this sort of concern goes back to Socrates and Plato, of course, the idea that, well, is it wealth and those sorts of things that will give us a good life and make us happy? Or is it justice or virtue, justice as a virtue or other sorts of virtues? So, yeah, I think there's a real claim here that if you have the right frame of mind, then you can be happy despite worldly misfortunes just by being a good person.
And that happiness that you have is a happiness that would be recognized as other people.
It's not the same, obviously, as the momentary subjective feeling of...
No, and Seneca
even brings this up in his letter on pleasure, right? There's a distinction we need to make between joy and pleasure and happiness. So that's part of the danger here is, yes, we want to say it's not completely unrecognizable and really defined as activity in accordance with virtue, but we don't want to make the mistake of simply identifying happiness with a kind of subjective pleasurable experience beforehand.
So, no, yes. That's right. And in fact, Aristotle himself, even before the Stoics, it was pretty clear what he meant by eudaimonia. So eudaimonia is the kind of life that you are on your deathbed and you look back to it and you say, yeah, that was good. That was worth living, which is nothing at all to do with happiness in terms of sort of pleasure and anything on anything like that, because you could imagine easily somebody having had a very easy life, right? And yet one during which that person completely wasted time and did things that were completely inconsequential and arriving at the end of his life and say, oh, shit, I really wasted my life despite having so many resources. And equally, you can imagine somebody not having those resources, even living an actually difficult your life and yet living it well. And then arriving at the end of the life says, yeah, well, you know, I didn't have this and that and the other, but I did what I could with the hand that was given to me. And I'm confident that I did a good thing, I had a good existence. So that, I think, is the meaning of what, in general, the virtuetical schools are talking about in terms of a good life.
Yeah. Another way of thinking about it is how we assess the value of our lives as a whole, or sometimes this is often related to whether or not we think our life is meaningful. And of course, people will pursue meaningfulness even at the cost of great pain. So it's obviously that could be a choice-worthy thing despite its conflict with a pursuit of pleasure.
The way Brennan puts it is that by the time we get to the Stoics, and certainly by these Roman Stoics, then the ancient Greek ethical tradition had already done the work in establishing that virtue equals happiness, that had become just a point of not really in contention in philosophy, even though we see in some of these essays Seneca at least saying things like, well, certainly you can't consider mere pleasure, which could be associated with vice, to be part of happiness. But it's the way he does that is more just reminding the person he's addressing that this is, of course, something you believe, that this has already been something on the table. The way Brennan put it was that in the Republic, one of his prime concerns there was to establish this equation between happiness and virtue against claims that if you had the Ring of Gyges and could be invisible and steal things and be the best tyrant and that all that, wouldn't you be really happy? The way that he ended up doing this was hooking both up to mental health so that a properly ordered soul with the rational part in control is the best kind of soul, is the virtuous kind of soul. You can see it's the healthiest kind of soul. And that's also going to be what makes the person, and this is appealing to your sentiment, to your phenomenology, it's also what makes the person ultimately happy that you can reflect on.
It's the harmonization of those different parts of the soul that makes you happy. And it's the control of the rational over the irrational that makes you virtuous. So that's the what Brennan calls a bridge argument, where you bring those things together. And it's intuitively plausible because we can intuitively understand how conflict between those parts of the soul would make you miserable. So it's not like there's no argument for this sort of thing.
Yeah, and actually some modern philosophers have made the similar argument from a completely different perspective. Like think about Robert Nozick's thought experiment of the pleasure machine, for instance. That idea that if I told you that you could step into this machine and you would live a life that is entirely fictional, it's just nothing really about it, but you'll be constantly in pleasure, you can be fulfilling your every fantasy you want. His intuition is that, you know, most people would say, no, that's a wasted life because it's not real, even though it has the maximum amount of pleasure you can possibly imagine. And in fact, even without going to Nozick experiment, most people, I would wager, would say that a life lived in pure pleasure, let's say that it's given to you by constantly being hooked up to drugs, it's not a life worth living. And that is the same basic idea that not only the Stoics, but the ancient Greeks and Romans in general were after, that pleasure, of course, except the Epicureans, that pleasure by itself is just not, it's not going to do it. In fact, it leads you down to a road where at the end of your life, you say, well, that was wasted time.
But it's certainly not sufficient to argue that pleasure is not going to be enough to give you a meaningful life. There's a giant leap between that and saying what will give you happiness, what will amount to virtue is the harmonization of your faculties and the rational ruling over the irrational, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, somebody like Nietzsche is going to violently reject that, but
keep in mind that that's not the Stoic model of the soul. They reject that model. And this is sort of relevant to this idea that of the passions versus the healthy passions, right? So we might better think of them as impulses.
Well, I see this in Seneca.
And impulses can be rational. It's not that you have to have the rational part of you put down all those other passions. It's just that you need to cultivate the rational passions, the healthy passions.
Well, how is that different than the dichotomy that Mark was bringing up?
If the passions in question are things like joy and volition, they involve knowing that certain actions are actually good because they're virtuous, as opposed to mistaking food for a good thing when it's not. It's a way of changing what you believe to be true. It's a way of acquiring a certain kind of knowledge. And it's not like by acquiring that knowledge, you are simply repressing the old knowledge, right? You come to know something and that changes you. I know now that it's not food that's good for me, it's being temperate that's good. And once I have that knowledge, it's no longer a struggle not to be a glutton, for instance. It's not a putting down of the irrational, passionate side of myself.
That's an interesting leap right there. What you just described is that I will no longer struggle against these passions and desires when I actually know what's going on. And the flip side of that, of course, is that what's wrong with me when I want something that's bad for me is that I don't really know that it's bad for me.
Because knowledge is also a technical term for the Stoics. You might believe it's bad for you, but knowing it's bad for you is a whole different thing. It involves not just that belief or what the Stoics would call assent to that impression, but it involves a certain amount of commitment to it. It involves you not being thrown off that by the circumstances of life. So to know that food is not good, to actually know that, doesn't involve just believing that because I read it in the Stoics. It means you'd have to be tested and you'd have to pass those tests of temptation, let's say.
Yeah, which is why the Stoics had an emphasis on practice, you know, both, not only Seneca, but Epictetus. Epictetus in several places says, you know, it's all good to study the theory, but then, you know, people forget the theory as soon as they're actually faced with a real life situation, which is why you have to constantly remind yourself. That's why the Stoics had this emphasis on these short little reminders, phrases to themselves. Whenever you are exposed to a problem, you remind yourself forcefully of the way you should be thinking about it. And hopefully over time, your cognition changes your actual desires.
At least for the hardline Stoics, it's only the Stoic sage or the wise person who can know these things and who can act virtuously. It's sort of an all or nothing. And I think we see some of this in Seneca. It's sort of an all or nothing thing. So even if we're making progress, even if we start selecting things and not seeing them as good or bad necessarily, but just preferable or not preferable, until we've rounded everything out and reached Stoic sagehood, we're not actually acting virtuously and we're not acting on the basis of knowledge. Seneca might be a little more lax on that, or conflicted is what I thought from reading the letters. But
I'm just wondering about the lumping in of the knowledge with the cultivated, practiced virtue. They don't seem to me like the same thing. I mean, it seems to be perfectly understandable and admissible that you would know what was good, but that you were incontinent with respect to it. In that distinction is where the whole notion of progress would come. And it's not a question of your knowing. It's a question of your ability to accede to your own best practices.
But you're just re-describing the difference between them and a more Platonic conception of the soul. So you couldn't be acratic once you have knowledge. But again, it's not unmotivated. And so there's room for disagreement. I think Dylan is disagreeing, but it's this different conception of the soul where to know something, you might believe that something is good and then be...
Yeah, no, it's Platonic in that respect, right? It's a funny kind of combination of Platonic conception and Aristotelian conception, right? Is that you don't actually know. Your knowledge is linked with your virtue. Whereas in Aristotle, you would know, but you could be incontinent. There's a distinction to be made there. And here, the Stoic is saying, well, if I'm not actually fulfilling that virtuous act, that's a sign that I don't actually know. It's all or nothing in that respect.
Knowledge confers virtue, which is, I think there's some of that in Plato and Aristotle too, but it's, you know, I don't want us to get bogged down on that. I think we have enough of the background to actually get into the text now before it's too late.
Sounds good to me.
A lot of the way you're putting these things, I don't see very much in Seneca at all. Maybe we can start on the happy life since we've been talking about eudaimonia. And Wes, you were just saying that, Seneca doesn't agree, or, you know, the Stoics don't necessarily agree with Plato about how the irrational has to be subservient to the rational. Well, on the happy life, verse one, he gives this whole schematic outline of how the different parts of the soul. Okay. So you and I will agree, I think, that outward things are sought for the satisfaction of the body, that the body is cherished out of regard for the soul, and that in the soul there are certain parts which minister to us, enabling us to move and sustain life bestowed on us just for the sake of the primary part of us. Okay, well, what is this primary part of us? In this primary part, there's something irrational and something rational. The former, the irrational, obeys the latter. So this is not obviously a pure description. This is like in the well-functioning body, how it's supposed to work. While the latter, the rational part, is the only thing that is not referred back to another, but rather refers all things to itself. For the divine reason also is set in supreme command over all things and is itself subject to none. And even this reason, which we possess, is the same because it is derived from the divine reason. That sounds very much like what we just saw in Aristotle's De Anima, that the rational part is, well, okay, this is straight out of Plato, but the rational part should rule over the irrational part. And then the part from Aristotle, which I guess is also from Plato, is that, well, the reason for that is the rational is somehow hooked up to the divine reason. What did you guys think of this phrase? The latter, in other words, the rational part of the soul, is the only thing that is not referred back to another, but rather refers all things to itself. What does that mean?
Yeah, I have, as you know, I'm using a slightly different translation, but in this case, it's pretty close. It says the former is at the service of the latter, which is the one thing that does not look at to anything else, but rather refers everything else to itself. Yeah.
Look to everything else in what sense?
Reason finds ends within itself.
Okay, so it's not obeying anything else.
Yes.
No.
So it's not obeying divine reason then. Yep. It is participating in divine reason. It is divine. I mean, this sounds exactly like what we uncovered in Aristotle's De Anima.
Yes.
That insofar as we are controlled by the reasonable part of us, we, in a sense, are God. We are participating in godness. This is...
Yeah, well, in that language, though, is throughout Seneca, right, is the whole idea of being godly. Not necessarily in the Christian sense, but maybe even just the Greek sense of just that the ways in which human beings are like gods is through our reason.
In the Greek sense, like a womanizer Zeus. No, not that Greek sense.
Now, we need to remember that the Stoics had a particular conception of God, which definitely it's not the Christian God outside of space and time, you know, a person or anything like that. God is nature. God is the universe. I mean, Epictetus, for instance, uses those terms interchangeably. Throughout the Stoic tradition, it's clear that what the Stoics mean by God is the sum total of the causal powers that make nature. So when Seneca is saying that we are part of God, that we participate in God, that's what he means. We're part of nature. More importantly, we are actually blessed, so to speak, with participating in the rational part of nature. It's not that somehow rationality is connected to God in the sense that God is an external thing. God is everywhere, and therefore it's also in us. We are part of the universe when we're part of God.
And is this associated with logos? Because the divine reason is also set in supreme command over all things. That sounds like a fancy way of saying nature obeys natural law.
That's right. Yep. Exactly. The logos for the Stoics, you know, the logos has a long history. And of course, it's been interpreted in a number of ways as a concept that precedes the Stoics. And of course, it was used then later by the Christians in a very different way. But for the Stoics, the logos is the rational principle that permeates the universe. Yes.
But here's the difference is that when we say natural law, we're giving something that's purely descriptive. We come up with the law of gravity or something by just looking at a lot of instances and putting them together. And there's some sort of normative component that if you say, well, it looks like that thing is not obeying the law of gravity, then you don't say the law of gravity is wrong. You look for some reason, you know, something that is preventing the thing from falling or are there other bodies acting on it. You look for other causal factors that are involved. So in that sense, it's normative in that it controls how we explain some of the details. That's quite different than the basically teleological view of nature. That he's saying at the same time, people are prone to fall into error. People are prone to obey the irrational part of them. But yet, the way of nature is for the rational to be in control. So even though nobody is the Stoic sage, we all are infected with this imperfection. So much of this is so obvious why Augustinians would leap on this. Oh yes, original sin, nobody's really the sage, it's only Jesus, you know, something like that. Yeah, so this great distinction between saying, oh yes, it's natural, the good is natural, but what I mean by natural, oh, it's natural law, but that's describing things, but it's not kind of describing how things actually, it's describing how things are if they're really working properly, which they hardly ever are.
So following nature is one of these big Stoic themes, and it really means two things. One has to do with human nature, but then there's this idea of nature in general, and I think the idea of following that has something to do with accepting one's fate even when it's unfortunate, because it happens according to nature. It's sort of the laws of the universe are executed, and sometimes that's not so hot for us, but that's what we will. We will things to happen as they happen because it's according to that sort of nature.
Amor fati, right? Love your
right,
fate.
Exactly. Yeah.
That doesn't seem very far from Marx's criticism of it being essentially teleological. That is a proper end. It might not be an end in the sense of flourishing that we would normally think of it that way, but it would be a proper end that it was directed towards.
An end according to nature. So here's one way in which I've heard a number of modern scholars of Stoicism put it. The view of the cosmos that the Stoics had was of the universe as an organism, as opposed to contrast that with the Galilean Newtonian view of the universe as a machine or something close to it, right?
Yep.
So the mechanistic view, which is the one that modern science has, as opposed to a sort of an organismic view. So if you think of the cosmos as an organism, then it makes perfect sense to say that certain things work properly or improperly, right? It's like, imagine the analogy with a human body. I mean, your heart can work properly and improperly, or your legs can work properly and improperly. And the Stoics apply the same thing to the universe. That's why I think their metaphysical position is best characterized as pantheistic, because they saw the entire universe as permeated by basically being an organism.
I like that, and it makes a lot of sense because we sort of intuitively know what it means to talk about being healthy. Unless we start asking more questions about it, you can often just look at an organism or being an organism, understand what it means to be working right, and understand that that's not merely a normative thing exactly. Speaking of it as, this is what legs were supposed to do, and to see them doing it and doing it well is natural, it's fulfilling its own natural character. There's a lot of intuitive sense to that way of speaking about it. It seems like if we talk about the universe as an organism, it makes the language that we're talking about more sensible, but it also sort of dodges the question about what we mean by talking about an organism fulfilling its
because you wouldn't think that a properly functioning organism involves the liver killing the kidneys, but yet we can have things in nature that, there's a cataclysm and the earth blew up, but that was part of a natural process.
Diabetes is a perfect example. Because my pancreas isn't working properly, then I have all these sorts of metabolic problems that mess up my body and I might lose my feet or I might go blind. On the one hand, we want to say there's something wrong with your body. Your organism is not working properly. And it makes sense because there's a system in your body that has an organ, and that organ isn't doing what it's supposed to be. And now your body isn't working as it was before. But it's also true that the fact that you're going blind and the fact that you lose your feet is an utterly natural consequence of the fact that this organ died, or this organ isn't working properly. So this is where the notion of using the word functioning naturally as a goal of Stoic philosophy or anything else, it's like saying the food is more natural and therefore I should eat it, right? Or there are chemicals in my food and therefore they're bad. You sort of understand what they mean, but it's sort of misunderstanding what's going on. It's making a normative claim about those things and trying to be rhetorical about it rather than say, well, look, my body's full of chemicals and it's a natural process for me to lose my feet if I put a tourniquet on my leg, right?
You brought up very clearly that there are different ways of interpreting the word natural. And I think that is something that the Stoics were definitely aware of. They were not counseling going back to nature as in, tree hugging and living in a cave or something like that. That's why, we made earlier on the distinction between nature as in cosmic nature on the one hand and also nature as in human nature on the other hand. For the Stoics, human nature was the nature of a social animal capable of rationality, which means that to act according to nature for a human being, as Seneca famously actually put it in, I think it was in the Tranquillitate Animis, he says, bring reason to bear upon your problems. That's what is in the nature of a human being to do. We are social and we're capable of rationality. So to follow nature for a human being means to use reason to help with social life. And it's very distinct from saying, well, an earthquake is natural and so I have to accept it. Yes.
Yeah, it is interesting here, though. So in this letter 92, in the second section, the question here is what happiness requires. And as he puts it in my translation, it requires our attainment of perfect reason. So what does that mean exactly? And it does have something to do with this comportment towards fortune or these external events that occur according to nature in some sense or another. And it allows us to be untroubled by them. That's really what reason is good here for. This is section...
Yeah, section two, right?
Yeah, section
two. So at the end of that section, the very last phrase is, in my translation, who wants to rely on fortune and what intelligent person flatters himself because of things that do not belong to him? This is a classic Stoic theme of, your happiness, the goodness of your life depend on things that are under your control, not on things that are up to fortune.
Which sounds like a sort of, as it's argued, a kind of wishful thinking, right? Well, if the only way to be undisturbed, do you see what I'm saying? So the idea is that if we allow fortune to have the upper hand, then we're going to be disturbed by it. But maybe fortune does have the upper hand. So it's phrased in the sort of pragmatic, well, what's going to make us happy? But maybe the way things are is just are such that we can't be happy, right? So you actually have to make the argument that good and bad is not external to us in our virtue. That actually has to be argued on its own terms if this is to be successful. You can't simply say, well, I can't be happy, you know, and it must be the case that we can be happy. Maybe we can't be happy.
Or let's redefine happiness so that it's something that we can attain because we still want to have that concept on our plate. If fortune has the upper hand, would make us unhappy, then let's redefine happiness so it only concerns things that we can control.
There's the famous metaphor that Epictetus uses of the dog on a leash connected to the cart, right? Which actually goes back to Nietzsche's Amor Fati. Because of the causality of the universe, the causal web of the universe, things just happen in a certain way. So we are like the dog that is connected by a leash to a cart. And the dog has two choices. He can either drag himself on the ground, kicking and screaming because he doesn't like where the cart is going, in which case he's going to be miserable and hurting himself. Or he can just gingerly trot along with the cart and enjoy the landscape because he's accepting his fate. He's accepting things that he cannot control, like the cart. I actually find that metaphor fairly useful in terms of there are certain things that you really just, there's no sense in reacting against or trying to change them because they're not in your control. They're not in there. There's nothing you can do about it. You're getting upset at the weather. It's just silly.
So it's reinterpreting the, when it says, who desires fortune to have the upper hand? Well, of course, fortune, if it's like the cart, does have the upper hand in that it is an objective thing that we can't rebel against effectively. But giving it the upper hand is really something that's psychological.
Yes, that's right.
You don't have to give the person holding you prisoner control over your soul. This makes it then sound like not so much an argument for Stoicism, but yet another way of expressing Stoic sentiments that are already on the table.
Yeah, again, I think you have to make an argument about what is actually good and bad. And we gave some of that in our background when we discussed the parts of the soul and harmony. And that's a deeper and more complex question of how we justify that.
And that's what makes me see is the religious aspect in this, that going back to the discussion we were having near the beginning, if you lose something that's merely preferred, your wife dies, your kid dies, then it doesn't really count as a loss because it's ultimately not something, you're not losing something that is ultimately important. And epistemically, what justifies this claim, what is important, what is not important, you would think as an empiricist, which at least reading Brennan, he's saying the Stoics, like the Epicureans, didn't buy Plato's solution of, well, we know the good ultimately because of the forms. No, they seem to know it's because of our experiences. In other words, it's appealing to phenomenology. This whole like looking at nature is a matter of you're supposed to be able to open your eyes and see, oh, this is nature. This is what it's about. So it has to have some relation to what people actually find important themselves. But in the same way, this issue that I brought up with teleology, well, maybe some people find things important because they're just wrong, because they're corrupt. And in fact, that is the norm. Most people are in error about what the good is. So to figure out what is truly important, we can't just ask them or ask them even to think deeply, though that's getting more in the right direction. It has to go in the direction, like you were saying, Massimo, of you're on your deathbed and you reflect back what is, what's not important. Well, let's talk to people on their deathbeds. Let's do a poll of what they find and then use their wisdom back to us. But it seems that ultimately these things come down to some sort of phenomenology. So what are the epistemic issues involved in arguing either against someone else's phenomenology? You have heterophenomenology. So we were discussing in the faith episode, people that just, I just see as a basic thing. This is Plantinga. The goodness of the flower is a product of God. I'm not actually putting forward a physical theory there. I'm just stating this is my narrative of explaining the world. It's a way of expressing really ultimately a moral position. And so there, we were left in that discussion with, okay, I guess intelligent people can differ in these phenomenological calls. And I'm not in an epistemic position to say, you are venal. You don't know it, but you are not wise. I have the proper story. But yet, of course we do this. And so as an atheist, I do find, even though I can't have this strong epistemic ground to condemn the religious for their narrative, I still think it's crazy. And likewise, with this yeah. Stoic stuff, if you want to say, you know, I know that losing my wife, my kid, that's not preferred. It is normal that that would make me want to cry. But what's really important is my own reaction to that. And these loss of these preferred things are not ultimately the loss of something that's important, that the deep deepest fundamental moral principle is something that you just can't read off of your immediate emotional reactions to things because those things are corrupt. I see that take on Stoicism as crazy in the same way that you probably think that some religious points of view are crazy.
But I also think it's not necessarily the best take on Stoicism. So the way Epictetus uses that metaphor of, or the situation of, you know, sort of losing somebody, he says, you know, it was never yours to begin with. You didn't lose it. You just gave it back. I think that is an interesting nuance there that needs to be emphasized, because a reasonable way of interpreting what Epictetus is saying there is not that losing somebody is not important. Of course, it's important, although it's not in the same category as virtue, right? So we talked earlier about a category mistake. So there are two different ways of being important. If a preferred indifferent is in fact preferred, then in some sense of the word important, it is important to you. But it is in a different category than the pursuit of virtue and being a moral person. But putting it in terms of you didn't lose something because it was never yours to begin with, it's a way to put things in perspective. It's a way of saying, look, you enjoyed the company of that person while she was alive, and you were lucky enough to do that. And now that it's gone, the best thing you can do is simply, you know, to accept the thing with equanimity. There's nothing you can do about it to reverse it. It is part of the cycle of the universe. Death is part of what happens. It's a condition to be alive. Actually, Seneca says at some point, one of the conditions to be alive is that eventually you're going to die. There is this sort of broader perspective, a cosmic perspective. Things are never yours. When you talk about your children or your wife or your husband, they're not yours. They're just lent to you by the universe. And then the universe takes them back.
And I like that you're using this sort of theological language there, because you're completely illustrating my point. Sure. That this sounds very much like the Plantinga example that I just gave of he wants to take as properly basic these sorts of divine things. That, of course, I would say my wife, my kids were not actually mine, but to then extend it and to say, oh, well, they actually belonged to the universe and now I'm giving them back. That's a bit of artistic sophistry. That's a narrative. And that's exactly the kind of thing that our guest on the religion episode was saying you can't argue with. I have my own narrative for making sense of this crazy universe and you have yours. And it's just a matter of heterophenomenology. The fact your narrative doesn't make any sense to me and mine doesn't, you know, so we're always just appealing to each other. What Seneca is doing in these letters is he's appealing to his reader, which of course they have, you know, a common belief system. But by extension, since apparently these were meant to be literary efforts and not merely personal letters as well, the language is quite formal and not. There's some things that he's referring to in passing, as if we should know what Lucilius just wrote to Seneca. That would be nice if he had put that in these essays as well. So there's some evidence that they're not purely literary, that they are also personal. But in any case, he's trying to make the case to a wider audience, a persuasive case that you should accept this narrative, that it jibes with your intuitions that you have already.
There are no theoretical justifications in these letters, which is why we're not discussing these cases. You want to discuss these theoretical justifications, but that's not the text we have in front of us.
Well, I think we should do that in the second half of this episode, and this seems like a wonderful place to wrap up the first half.
Hey everyone, this is Nathan Hanks with The Partially Examined Life, and I have just a short update about our Not School and Citizens Forum. That's the place where you can find other members to talk about interesting topics. Maybe you want to start a group on Consciousness Explained by Daniel Dennett, that's going on. Also, Intro to Analytic Philosophy. That's just right now. You can propose your own in the Citizens Forum. Just go to thepartiallyexaminedlife.com. If you'd like to contact me with any questions, you can. That's Nathan at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks for listening.
So that's the end of the first half. You want to listen to the second half, you got to wait till next week, or else get the citizen version of the episode, which you can do right now at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Just become a Partially Examined Life citizen. It's only $5, and you will be eternally happy because it is really within your control.